Due to the graphic nature of this spy's life and crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of violence, war, and sexuality that some people may find offensive. We advise caution for children under the age of 13. In the fall of 1943, Double Agent Dushko Popov needed a break from all the burdens of espionage, namely, the threat to his cover and life that were haunting him after an unsuccessful mission to the United States. Hence, his retreat to the farm of his wealthy Yugoslavian friends, the Bilonis. Popov pulled up to their residence in style, as usual. Stepping out of his beloved Jaguar, he was greeted by the Bilonis' effervescent daughter, Lilyanya. She asked if they could go for a ride. Not feeling up for another drive, Popov tossed her and her male friend the keys, and off they went, leaving Popov to rest, if only for a little while. 4 hours later, Lilyanya and her companion returned, but not in the car they left with. Breathlessly, Lilyanya explained what happened, saying, "Your car, Dushko, it exploded. We were swimming and it just exploded all by itself." Was it the Germans? Or perhaps it was the British? Turns out, it was neither. According to the head of MI6, it was the Americans. A group of FBI agents discovered that Popov was working for the Nazis, but they hadn't dug deep enough to find out that he was in fact a double agent, working first and foremost for the British. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. This is our second episode on Serbian double agent Dushko Popov, who passed off disinformation to Germany while working for MI6, MI5, and the FBI. His story, full of intrigue, murder, and sex appeal, is one of the inspirations behind none other than Ian Fleming's James Bond. Last week, we heard how Popov was recruited by both Germany's Abwehr and Britain's MI6, but gave his true loyalty to the Allies. While on assignment in America, he secured information that could have stopped Pearl Harbor, but his efforts were thwarted by the FBI's politics of suspicion. This week, we'll follow Popov as he returns to Europe and his Nazi spy masters. We'll see how the double agent had to work harder than ever before to keep his cover intact and ensure that D-Day happened. The FBI didn't trust Dushko Popov. Some agents went so far as planting a bomb in Popov's car, convinced that he was a Nazi spy. But the Americans' distrust had him reeling, even before the bomb went off. By the summer of 1942, it was clear that Popov's mission to the U.S. had been a bust. Thanks to the suspicious FBI chief J. Edgar Hoover, the Americans wouldn't provide Popov or his MI5 handlers with substantial enough intel to appease his German masters. And without good intel, Popov's loyalty to the Abwehr was being called into question. Popov was tired of the FBI's bureaucratic games and only saw one way out. he asked to be reassigned to Portugal. There, at least, he could explain his failure to his Nazi spy masters on his own terms. His request was approved. In October 1942, Popoff crossed back over the Atlantic. En route to Lisbon, Popoff, as usual, made friends. He hit it off with several American diplomats. They took him out to the casino the night they arrived, ready to gamble and drink their worries away. But Popoff couldn't delay the inevitable. Slipping away from the group, he found a payphone. It was time to make the call he'd been dreading to his Nazi handler, Major von Kastoff. Von Kastoff's secretary, Elizabeth, answered, and immediately Popoff could tell something was off from the hesitation in her voice. But both parties did their best to pretend everything was normal. Elizabeth informed Popoff that she would pick him up the next morning. She would take him to a secure spot to meet with von Kastoff and debrief his U.S. mission. That spot turned out to be an urban apartment complex within Lisbon. With von Kastoff was an Abwehr official Popoff had never met, Lieutenant Kammler. He was a quiet, intense man who looked much older than his 28 years. Making his usual suave chit-chat and delaying the meat of the meeting, Popoff mentioned that he'd been with a group of American diplomats the night before. Von Kastoff responded, "I know." Nothing more was to be made of his keeping company with Americans. Von Kastoff and Lieutenant Kammler were more interested in Popoff's explanation for his wasted time in America. But Popoff was ready for this, and immediately went on the offensive. He blamed the Germans for his shortfalls, saying, "You send me there with no help whatsoever, no contacts, a few miserable dollars, and you expect me to produce results in no time?" Von Kastoff heard him out, and then started to rail about the Abwehr's disappointment with Popoff. Popoff sat stock still, praying this meeting wouldn't end with a blow to the head and imprisonment in the motherland. But the fact that he was still conscious was a good sign, and a few minutes later, von Kastoff abruptly stopped his berating and acknowledged Popoff's point. The failure of the mission was Berlin's fault. The reprimands were apparently just a warning. Popoff was distrustful of the ease with which the Abwehr officials accepted his failed U.S. mission, but he also understood that von Kastoff and Lieutenant Kammler had just as much vested interest in his success as he did. If Popoff failed, that wouldn't just look bad for him, but also for his Lisbon spy masters. He'd trust their confidence in him for now. Over the next couple of days, Popoff and his handlers planned his next mission, to England. The goal was to recreate the success of his first mission there several years prior. The Germans were hopeful, but Popoff was confident. What he knew, and the Germans didn't, was that the British were guaranteed to be more welcoming than the Americans. After all, they were his primary employers. On October 22, 1942, Popoff returned to England. And this time, with the help of his British masters, he made sure to feed the Abwehr a constant stream of apparently valuable intel. This included the names of high-ranking military officers, documents detailing relief efforts for German-invaded countries, and some misleading numbers regarding Allied resources. Popoff relayed this intel to the Germans through letters written on airmail paper with invisible ink. He used specifically designed matches to help encrypt the secret messages. Over the next several months, most of Popoff's espionage was conducted from his desk, which, of course, was boring. Popoff wanted back in on the action with a high-stakes bet. Hence his project in the spring of 1943, Popov decided to create an underground escape route for Yugoslav officers stranded across Europe. He conceived of the idea with the aid of his two most trusted friends and fellow secret agents. The first was his old university buddy and Abwehr recruiter, Johnny Jebsen. The second was his older brother, Ivo. Throughout the past several months, Ivo and Johnny had been unofficially doubling for the British, working within Popov's Tricycle spy network. Together with this duo, Popov pitched the escape route to both British and German intelligence. The idea was that under Popov and Ivo's supervision, the route would allow the Nazis to recruit new spies disguised as Yugoslav escapees. But unbeknownst to the Germans, these new spies would in fact be cherry-picked by Ivo as potential double agents for MI5 and MI6. Throughout May of 1943, the British agencies contemplated approving the route. It was a risky proposal. They'd be putting a great deal of trust in recruits they wouldn't have the chance to vet until their arrival in England. And they were fearful of the new recruits turning and doubling for the Germans instead of the British. But those were always the risks of the double agent games. And they knew that with Popov, risk and reward came hand in hand. By June of 1943, British intelligence and the Yugoslavian Prime Minister approved the route. That summer, the British were able to funnel the first wave of Yugoslav civilians and potential new recruits into England. The escape route would significantly expand Britain's command of wartime intelligence. Sir J.C. Masterman, head of the Double Cross Committee, later verified the program's overall success, saying it allowed British intelligence to actively run and control the German espionage system in England. Meanwhile, the Nazis had no reason to suspect anything was amiss with Popov. He was, from their vantage point, doing excellent work for the Third Reich. It seemed like the perfect time to return to Portugal and start some new scheme. But as Popov's travel documents were being prepared, British intelligence received some alarming news. Ian Wilson, Popov's handler and Double Cross Chief Colonel Tar Robertson, knocked on Popov's door. They sat their spy down and suggested he cancel his trip to Lisbon. His life and the lives of everyone in his spy network were in jeopardy. All thanks to a 27-year-old Czech named Stefan Zeiss, codenamed The Worm, who had been spotted at Abwehr headquarters in Paris. The catch was that the Worm had been among the first wave of double agents sent through Popov's escape route. Since the Worm had been spotted mingling with German intelligence before being vetted by the British, he was likely compromised. And the Worm knew everything. Ivo had been briefing him on the Tricycle network for months. This meant that Popov, along with the integrity of the escape route, was in all likelihood exposed. Once again, he faced death at the hands of the Nazis if he so much as set foot off of British soil. Coming up, Popov puts his own life and the lives of his closest friends in harm's way. Now back to the story. In the summer of 1943, Popov sat across from his British handlers as they told him the worst news a spy can hear. Your cover is as good as blown. According to MI5, a double agent codenamed The Worm had turned. On a recent trip to the Abwehr headquarters in Paris, The Worm had most likely outed the Tricycle network to the Nazis. Wilson and Robertson recommended that Popov cancel his trip to Portugal. Popov was alarmed. He knew what the Nazis were capable of doing to those who betrayed them. Death would be the least of it. but he'd been through this sort of thing before, back when he returned from the United States. He'd been sure the Nazis were prepared to tear off his cover, but with the help of a silver tongue, he'd weathered it. He would weather it again. After all, if he survived, he'd be burrowed even deeper in the Nazi intelligence world, with even more power to help the Allies beat these fascists. It was decided. Popov would continue on to Portugal despite the risk. Still, he packed a pistol, just in case. Popov arrived in Lisbon on July 16, 1943, ready to face any questions the Germans might have for him. Von Castorf and Lieutenant Kalmler would expect a full rundown of all intelligence collected in England, and in all likelihood, they would have questions about where his loyalties lay too. And if it came to it, he had his gun. But when Popov arrived at Von Castorf's villa, instead of being met with Von Castorf's weapons, he was met with his German spy master's new pet monkey. The monkey was a gift from an Abwehr agent stationed in Africa, Von Castorf explained cheerfully, patting his young protege on the back. Popov quickly forgot about his gun. There was no need for it, as it turned out. In fact, the Nazis seemed happier with Popov than ever. His mission to London, unlike the one to the US, had yielded plenty of useful information, after all. Whatever the worm had been doing in Paris, it clearly wasn't betraying Popov in the British. In fact, by August of 1943, British intelligence had recruited a new double agent into the Tricycle Network, the Worm. He had surfaced in London and wanted to talk to MI5. Popov's handler, Wilson, interviewed him and noted that the Worm made an extremely good impression. He possessed a natural charisma and passion for democracy that reminded Wilson of Popov. Worm explained to Wilson that he had always been on the Allies' side and was eager to be rolled into the double-cross system. While they were aware that the Worm might be lying, the British decided to trust him. Tricycle's double-agent network of three, originally consisting of Popov and sub-agents Gelatine and Balloon, continued to grow with the addition of Worm and others, including Popov's brother Ivo, codenamed Dreadnought, and best friend Johnny, codename Artist. With a growing spy network, Tricycle had more to gain and more to lose than ever before. But luckily for the Tricycle network, Popov's influence with the Abwehr was chugging along at an all-time high in late 1943. Suspicions about his performance felt like distant memories. And he and another agent, a Spaniard by the name of Juan Pujol, shared the top spot in the Abwehr agent hierarchy. Conveniently, Pujol also happened to be a double agent secretly working for the British, codenamed Garbo. The British were anxious to use Tricycle and Garbo before either of their favors fell, namely, in service of preparing for D-Day. In February of 1944, Operation Fortitude South was set in motion. The operation entailed British forces placing dummy military equipment at Dover. This would hopefully fool the Nazis into thinking that Dover was the location of their planned invasion instead of Normandy. Tricycle and Garbo were to ensure that misconception by feeding misinformation to Nazi intelligence. On February 26, 1944, Popov returned to Portugal after a brief trip to England, ready to sell the story of the Allied invasion at Dover. But he was met with an unexpected roadblock. Upon his arrival in Lisbon, Johnny informed him that he would be interrogated about his latest intel by members of the SD, that is, the intelligence agency of the SS. Over the past couple of months, the Abwehr had been steadily losing their power to the SD. This power shift meant that Popov's Nazi spymaster, von Kastorf, was reassigned to Austria in a bureaucratic shuffle. Not ideal. Popov knew von Kastorf, knew what to expect from him. He was a friend. A friend Popov continually lied to, but a friend nonetheless. They had a rapport. Now, in lieu of von Kastorf, Popov was to report to several SD officers along with the head of the Abwehr IH West, Major Alois Schreiber, commonly called Dr. Schreiber. And make no mistake, his first meeting with them would be an interrogation. He'd have to play his cards perfectly to gain their trust. To prepare for the interrogation, Popov enlisted Johnny's help. Together, they ran through the motions of potential questions and follow-ups. Popov wanted to have every answer at his fingertips, especially considering that his Nazi interrogators could resort to a truth serum. According to CIA archivist George Biemerle, truth serum is a mix of drugs which are presumed to relax the individual's defenses to the point that he unknowingly reveals truths he has been trying to conceal. In Popov's case, the drug of choice would likely be sodium pentothal, which the Germans had been experimenting with throughout 1944. Johnny acquired a sample of sodium pentothal so Popov could practice lying under its influence. Johnny administered the drug to Popov and ran down a whole list of questions the interrogators might ask. And despite the drug's relaxant effects, Popov didn't waver. But whether his dependability would hold under the eye of a foe rather than a friend was another story. On March 6, 1944, Popov arrived at the Club Sparta. After a mere day of practice, albeit an intensive one, Popov was forced to face his German interrogators. Dr. Schreiber and his associates initially played soft, politely asking him questions about British military initiatives and the reliability of his sources. But as the night wore on, they dug in, repeating questions they had already asked in order to wear Popov down. Luckily, they never resorted to truth serum. But even if they had, Popov had proven he had the gall to power through it. After 9 hours of questioning, Popov came out triumphant. The Germans had bought his story. Operation Fortitude was going to work. And Popov, for his part, was hailed as an intelligence hero by the Nazis and British both. Throughout the spring of 1944, Johnny regularly assured the British that Tricycle's story was still holding up within German intelligence circles. The Nazis weren't going to question Popov's fidelity anytime soon. Unfortunately, the same couldn't be said for Johnny. He had run into some trouble with the Gestapo, the Nazis' secret police. The problem was, they thought him the source of a deadly rumor. After one of his currency exchanges with the secret police, Johnny had complained that the notes were forged. Word then spread that some members of the Gestapo were making money at the expense of Nazi Germany. One of the Gestapo men was swiftly shot. The dead man's colleagues blamed Johnny for the mess and put a target on his back. The only thing stopping them from killing Johnny was the Abwehr. Therefore, it was vital that Johnny remained in the Abwehr's good graces. Whether or not the Abwehr protected him would be based on his work and the work of the agents he had recruited, with Popov at the top of that list. So, naturally, Johnny went to Popov asking for help. Popov, of course, accepted the weight of this responsibility. He loved Johnny and would do anything to protect him. Plus, protecting Johnny was in his own interests and the interests of the Allies. At this point, Johnny simply knew too much to be left vulnerable in Nazi hands. But that didn't mean Popoff could always be by Johnny's side. In April of 1944, soon after he planted the seeds of misinformation for Operation Fortitude, Popoff returned to England, leaving Johnny alone in Lisbon. On April 29th, 1944, Dr. Schreiber asked Johnny to his office in Lisbon. Setting him down in a private room, he told Johnny he had orders from Berlin to hand him over to the secret police. The Abwehr could no longer protect Johnny from his misdealings with the Gestapo, because the Abwehr no longer existed. Hitler had officially abolished the agency on February 18, 1944. According to former Inspector General of the CIA, John Henry Waller, Hitler had found the Abwehr suspect in terms of performance, leading him to conclude that the Abwehr and its leadership were basically incompetent. Standing in Dr. Schreiber's office, Johnny weighed his options. He wasn't going to go willingly to a Gestapo prison, not if he could help it. He made his way to the door, but a blow to the head stopped him short. Dr. Schreiber had knocked him out cold. After several days of silence from Johnny, MI5 discovered he'd been kidnapped. At first, perhaps fearing a reckless reaction, British intelligence didn't tell Popoff. But towards the end of May, Wilson, Popoff's British handler, went to him with the news. According to MI5 sources, Johnny had been drugged and stuffed in a trunk. His German abductors then shuttled him across the Portuguese border into Spain. Then, from France, they flew him to Berlin, where he was now being held at the Gestapo prison in Prince Albrechtstrasse. The British were concerned. They believed Johnny was likely to break under increased pressure from the Gestapo. Popoff, meanwhile, was adamant that Johnny wouldn't break. Not the Johnny he knew, at least. Still, he understood that if worse came to worst, Johnny could potentially expose Operation Fortitude, leaving the Tricycle Network out to dry. Everything, from Popoff's cover to the success of D-Day, hung in the balance. Coming up, Popoff fights to save his oldest friend as the war comes to a close. And now, back to the story. On June 6, 1944, the Allies invaded Normandy. Over the next several days, American and British forces rained fire on the Germans. The Nazis were woefully underprepared. As a result of Operation Fortitude, they'd been convinced the Allies were going to land at Dover, thanks, in no small part, to Dushko Popoff. Popoff's falsified intel on British military operations had fooled the Nazis at the highest level. And although Hitler and his henchmen knew that Britain's espionage war was getting the better of them, they failed to weed out its roots. For example, Popoff. After the Abwehr was abolished in February of 1944, SS powerhouse Walter Schellenberg swiftly took over as head of foreign intelligence for Nazi Germany. Popoff and the rest of the former Abwehr agents were absorbed into the SD, the intelligence branch of the SS. But despite Schellenberg's best efforts, Nazi intelligence was gradually becoming defunct. The power shift was little more than an organizational Hail Mary, a last stand as the Third Reich neared its end. With the Normandy invasion in full throttle, an Allied victory looked closer than ever before in the summer of 1944. The Yet while the Allies charged ahead, Popov's thoughts remained with the fate of his friend Johnny. With each passing day, the threat of Allied failure or even professional exposure diminished, but Popov's own personal war, as he would later state in his memoirs, was just beginning. Johnny was his best friend in the world, and he'd saved Popov's life multiple times before. Back in their university days, when Popov was arrested for being a communist sympathizer, then again, when Johnny discovered Popov was a double agent for the British and joined him rather than expose him. Popov had to find a way to save Johnny's life, but for now, he wasn't sure what he could do. He was stuck in England. MI5 and MI6 had ordered him to stand ground. They didn't want him risking a trip to Lisbon or Berlin, where he would likely be shot on the spot if his cover had been blown by Johnny or the ongoing Nazi intelligence shuffle. This stasis was already making Popov feel useless. Then, in the summer of 1944, he received a fresh blow. Another of his loved ones had been imprisoned. Ivo, his brother. The Gestapo had arrived at Ivo's doorstep and promptly escorted him to prison, where Ivo fully expected to be interrogated about his work as a double agent and then executed. Instead, the interrogation focused on forged currency Ivo had purchased. The Gestapo had no idea of the true extent of Ivo's betrayal. For now, he would live. In fact, he was even allowed to receive several care packages in his cell. One day, while rummaging through a care package sent from someone he'd been working with in the underground, he found a rolled-up piece of paper designed to look like a cigarette. The paper contained the floor plan for the Gestapo headquarters. The next time Ivo was taken in for interrogation, he broke free from the Gestapo guards and made his escape. Several weeks later, Ivo was found in the Serbian forest, absorbed into General Mihailovic's resistance forces. General Mihailovic sent word to the British about Ivo's escape and asked if they might aid in Ivo's evacuation. They promptly obliged. Meanwhile, Popov had escaped to Scotland for a few days, worn out from all the turmoil of the past few weeks. A couple of days into his vacation, Popov was awoken by a policeman, telling him that he was to immediately report to the War Office. Several hours later, Popov was standing in front of his brother, Ivo. They hadn't seen each other for years. The brothers filled each other in on everything that had led them to this point. After getting up to speed, Popov told Ivo of Johnny's plight. He asked Ivo if he might know of someone who could help. Ivo said he did. In late August of 1944, Popov flew to France following Ivo's lead. He arrived at an extravagant Parisian apartment. There, he was greeted by a rather skittish woman, whom Ivo had met on his escape line to the UK. Popov was looking for the woman's fiancé, Frederick Hahn. The woman told Popov he wasn't home, but it didn't take long for Popov to find him. Within minutes of his arrival, Frederick had a gun pointed at Popov's head. As usual, Popov responded to the danger by talking. He deftly explained that he meant no harm. He only wanted information on Johnny. Good old Johnny Jepsen. Frederick recognized the name and cautiously lowered his gun. He had worked with Johnny and liked him. If Popov wanted to help out the guy, he'd provide what little intel he had. Johnny's imprisonment was overseen by several SS officers, among whom were men by the names of Hofmeister and Quetting, men with reputations for violence. Popoff noted those names carefully. He also asked Frederick if he knew anyone who could help him free Johnny. Frederick hesitated and then continued. There was one potential SS officer who might help, a Dr. Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt was the right-hand man to leading SS officer Walter Schillenberg. If anyone had the power to help Johnny, it would be him. Popoff left the flat and immediately drafted a letter to Dr. Schmidt, pleading for Johnny's release. In it, he gave the Germans an ultimatum. Free Johnny, or Popoff would quit, bringing his network of contacts down with him. If they still believed him to be their top agent, the Nazis might consider his demands. If not, then his recklessness might bring more pain than gain. But he had to try. By October of 1944, Popoff received news that Dr. Schmidt had taken his letter to heart. It wasn't enough to free Johnny altogether, but Dr. Schmidt still used his influence to move Johnny from the Prince prison to Oranienburg, a concentration camp with slightly better conditions. He also sent a Captain Kammler to check on Johnny. According to Kammler, Johnny looked worse for the wear. Still, he had a glint in his eye when he said, quote, "Tell Dushko, I knew he wouldn't forget me." Still, this wasn't much. And for months after, Popoff received no more news about Johnny. Meanwhile, Popoff's work for the Nazis had come to a gradual close. As the Third Reich fell, so did the SD. There was little spying to be done when all roads pointed to an Allied victory. On September 2, 1945, World War II officially came to an end. Throughout the war, Popoff had gone above and beyond for the Allies and was deservingly awarded for it with an OBE, or Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. Popoff told his British spy masters he was leaving the intelligence world behind to work full-time as the businessman he'd been before the war, but not before he received word about the fate of his best friend. In the fall of 1945, British intelligence confirmed the worst. Johnny was dead. Hearing the news, Popoff was filled with rage. Rage against the man who killed his dearest friend. And he was eager to put his rage to use. In his memoirs, Popoff wrote, "Up until then, the war, for me, had been a matter of fighting for ideals, and, of course, getting paid for it. But avenging Johnny's death had nothing to do with money or ideals. He was my friend, and I was determined to kill the man who murdered him. In a sense, my war didn't start until the war ended." What he would actually do with that rage remains a question to this day. Throughout his memoirs, Popoff mentions an SS officer by the name of Walter Saltzer. He describes Saltzer as having a large scar on his face. What's more, he asserts that Saltzer was always seen wearing a glove over his battle-burnt hand, a Bond villain in the flesh. Popoff was sure Saltzer had killed Johnny. And so after the war, in the fall of 1945, Popoff tracked Saltzer down. He drew him into a forest and pointed a gun to his head. He asked the man point blank, "Who killed Johnny Jebsen?" Saltzer pleaded with Popoff, blaming his superiors for the execution order. That didn't matter to Popoff. His friend was dead, and now his executioner would pay. Popoff was ready to pull the trigger. But instead, he dropped his gun and pummeled his fists into Saltzer in a dramatic outpouring of rage and grief. Popoff didn't kill Saltzer. At least he claimed he didn't. He simply beat him to a pulp before abandoning him in the woods. But the fact of the matter is, Walter Saltzer didn't exist. According to historian Larry Loftus, Popoff made Saltzer up in his memoirs. Perhaps because he knew who Johnny's real killer was and went through with killing him, a crime in post-war Europe. Loftus further postulates that Johnny's true killers and Popoff's murder victims might have been Hoffmeister and Quetting, the two SS officers who were known to have handled Johnny after his kidnapping, who Popoff, thanks to Frederick's tip, knew handled Johnny. Still, to this day, no one knows for certain who killed Johnny, or if Popoff might have avenged him by killing his murderer. It wouldn't have been hard for Popoff to keep both facts under wraps. He had been both Britain and Germany's top secret agent, after all. He was more than capable of telling lies in order to survive. But Popoff did more than just survive the war. He thrived in its wake. After retiring from espionage, Popoff settled down and married Jeanine Ducasse on March 6, 1946, much to the surprise of any and all who knew the playboy. Together, Popoff and Jeanine had a son, whom they named Dean. Given the tumultuous post-war state of his home country, Popoff asked his former MI5 handlers if he might become a British citizen. They promptly obliged, and on June 12, 1946, Dushko was naturalized. Ivo, Popoff's brother, was naturalized a year later. Popoff's family was safe and growing, but of course this was Popoff, and his post-spying world still had its fair share of drama. First, a bitter divorce from Jeanine, after which Popoff married a Yil Yonson. Together, they had three sons, Marco, Boris, and Omar. Then Popoff rocked his family with the revelation that he'd been a double agent, a fact he hid until the 1974 publication of his memoir, Spy Counter Spy. He'd been barred from telling his family until Britain's wartime records were declassified in the 1970s. Besides, Popoff had wanted a clean break from espionage when he started his family. Or had he? Some historians have speculated whether Popoff continued to serve British intelligence even after the war. Within the pages of his memoir, Popoff assures his readers that secret agents do retire. But Popoff had played both sides before. Why not go out with one last double cross? Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. For more information on Dushko Popoff, amongst the many sources we used, we found Spy Counter Spy by Dushko Popoff and Into the Lion's Mouth by Larry Loftus extremely helpful. You can find more episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Espionage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Espionage on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Brian Golub, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Espionage was written by Justine Bede, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher. I'm Carter Roy.